The Reformation, Part 1, the sixth talk in a series entitled Church History, was presented by Peter Waringa on May 8, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. Before I get started, last time we really didn't have much time for questions. Did anybody have any questions about the material we've covered thus far? Any things that we need to go over again or anything like that? Margaret.
This is kind of way back there. But I haven't read anything of Augustine, and so I think maybe I should be trying to figure out the answer to my own question. But my question is, if he was unduly influenced by his Manichean background in terms of thinking that sex is something that's inherently evil or at least an inferior way of life. Is it possible that the lion's share of his sense of his being a sinner came from his distress at finding himself a sexual being? That he was actually experiencing false guilt for being a sexual being instead of true guilt. I mean, he believed that there was something wrong with having sexual urges, and so he was grieving over something that he shouldn't have been grieving over.
Does anybody else have any questions? I would not be able to give you a good answer on that one. If I suggested to you that he was unduly influenced, I don't know that that's necessarily accurate. And it's been a while since I've really read much Augustine, so I'm not sure if I were to reread the Confessions, something like that right now, I'm not sure exactly what I would think about it. When I read the Confessions when I was much younger, it did not seem to me as though he was out of balance, particularly with his perspective. I'm not sure how best to answer that question. Well, there's a lot there to read. Do you have any?
The first thing that he talks about the Confessions of Schemes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that he just generally. I think he had a very generalized sense of his own sin, his own unworthiness. So if I suggested that it was really focused on that, I don't think I'm doing you a service in that.
You didn't say that. That was just something more
I think that his struggle was more clear before he became a Christian. That was when he seemed to struggle with that more, and that would be when he was more influenced by the Manichees, when he was actually a part of the movement. So it would make sense there that was a struggle. Why didn't he marry the woman? I just don't know the answer to that question. He stayed faithful to her for many, many years. So I don't know exactly what was going on there, but I guess the sense that I have is that in that area, his struggle was more even before he became a Christian than later on. But that's the best I can do for you. So, all right. Well, let's jump into tonight's topic. We're going to finish off what we were looking at last week, which is sort of a prelude to the Reformation. We'll be talking about some of the influences that led up to the Reformation, and then we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about Martin Luther. And Martin Luther is just fun to talk about because there are so many stories, there's just so much about his life and his experiences that are interesting. So we'll spend most of our time on Luther. I had hoped to also begin covering some of the Anabaptist movement. But as I went through my outline, there's no way we're going to get to the Anabaptist movement. So we're going to focus on the end of the Renaissance period, and then we're going to talk about Martin Luther, talk about the Reformation. And where we're at in the lecture that we had last time, we were talking about the end of the Middle Ages, we were talking about the period of the Renaissance, and at rock bottom, I guess the most basic understanding that you need to have of the Renaissance is that that was a time when the confidence that the people had, the people of Europe, and I'm saying that generally because in the Middle Ages, Christianity really, truly was the dominant force, the dominant Catholic Christianity really was the most influential thing in all of Europe at that time. But by the time you get to the Renaissance, the period of the Renaissance, tremendous disillusionment had set in on a number of fronts. There were concerns about the corruption in the church. There were concerns about the political power that the church had. There were the obvious examples in front of just about everybody of the personal decadence of priests and of prelates in the church. So there was just tremendous disillusionment by the time we get to the Renaissance, all of which helped to pave the way then for the Reformation, open the door for the Reformation. So let's talk a little bit about the rise of humanism, because humanism as a movement was very influential in opening the door to the Reformation. And I'm going to suggest to you that humanism in Europe took two forms, one of which in Southern Europe was really a fairly secular form of humanism. Most of the humanists of that day, and well, let me back up even a step further and define what a humanist is. A humanist is not, in this context, is not what we tend to think of today in 2007 when we talk about a humanist. A humanist in that day and age was basically someone who focused on a study of the humanities, a study of the letters, art, literature. That was really the definition of a humanist. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that along with that, in the South, in Italy primarily, along with that really came a movement away from any commitment to God, to theological principles, to the church, or anything like that. That really was part of the humanist movement in the South. They were all in name Christian still, but in terms of interest, their interest was waning dramatically.
I was just wondering, what countries were considered the North and the East before the South?
When we talk about the Renaissance in the South, we're talking primarily about Italy. That really is where the Renaissance was focused. But it also, humanism spread way beyond that. France was very influenced. When we talk about these two different kinds of humanism, Northern humanism would have been in Germany and in the Low Countries, Netherlands, Belgium, primarily. Humanism, in terms of the more secular form, was sort of centered in Italy, but it was very widespread. France, England, it was very widespread, that particular form of humanism. So you would find people who, in name, were still Christians, but for all practical purposes, they were very disillusioned with the church and were pursuing other things, pursuing other studies. Well, the two forms, humanism in the South, humanism in the North, then, is referred to by historians as Christian humanism, because it used many of the same tools and it pursued many of the same things in terms of study and in terms of the principles that they followed, pursued many of the same things as the humanists in the South, but they were clearly, devoutly Christian in the North, devoutly Catholic Christian in the North. But there's a reason why the Reformation in Germany found such fertile ground, because Christian humanism in the North, in Germany and in the Low Countries, began to take the tools of scholarship and the emphases and the disillusionment with the church took all those things and paired it with a sincere devotion, and out of that, to a very large degree, came the Reformation itself. Logan.
What year was the Gutenberg Press?
Around 1450, somewhere in there. So right toward the end of the Renaissance. Okay, well, let's talk just a little bit about the Italian Renaissance. The Italian Renaissance was a revival of art and learning. One of the things that is most notable about the Italian Renaissance was the decline of scholasticism during this time. Scholasticism, you'll remember, was the theological system in the Middle Ages that shaped Catholic theology, even largely to this day, shaped it on the basis of doing whatever was necessary to reconcile faith and reason. That was the goal of scholasticism, that there was no reason to embrace something theologically that wasn't reasonable. And so the whole focus of the scholastics was to make sense of anything and everything that was part of the religious tradition and try and pull together, in that sense, pull together faith and reason. Well, part of the problem was that the scholastics became more and more confusing, became more and more arcane in their studies. I mean, they began to focus on such subtleties that after a while, people simply lost interest in what the scholastics were saying. For a couple of reasons. Number one, to understand what the scholastics were saying, you had to have read the same works, studied at the same places. I mean, I find this sometimes when I'm around Gutenberg students. There's a language that they have from the things that they've studied I don't understand. I mean, they're talking about terms, they're talking about things that is not a part of my world. Well, that was really true of the scholastics. So the scholastics, as they were writing and as they were teaching, they became less and less interesting to the people around them, to the point that people would begin to look at them, look at their discussions, the things that they were writing, and basically just see absurdity in what they were doing, because it didn't make sense to people, to the rank and file anymore. John Duns Scotus was one of the late scholastics. He lived from 1265 to 1308. He's known as the subtle doctor. He's known as the subtle doctor because the subtleties of his thought, they were so precise and so fine that people had a very, very hard time understanding him. And even Scotus began to recognize the limitations of scholastic thinking. William of Ockham, 1285 to 1347, began to move things in a different direction because his focus on God's omnipotence, God's sovereignty, was such that he, and I'm going to have a little bit of a hard time explaining this, but he was less concerned with making sure everything lined up reasonably and more concerned with focusing on God's omnipotence and God's basically ability to do what he's going to do regardless of whether or not it makes sense, regardless of whether or not it's something that we can reason out, was kind of the direction that he was going there. So even within the scholastic movement, as well as with people outside the scholastic movement, there was a disillusionment with just how unbelievably detailed you had to be to even understand what they were talking about. Well, along with that, about the same time came the recovery of classical learning, and what that is talking about is when the Ottoman Turks overran Byzantium in the middle of the 15th century, and even prior to that time, because of the pressure of the Turks on Byzantium, there were more and more people coming from Byzantium and coming to the West. Now, you'll remember from our lectures a couple of weeks ago, there had been this split between the East and the West going way back to Constantine when he moved the capital to Byzantium, to Constantinople. And so there had been this split for quite some time, not as much interaction between the scholars in the East and the West, But now, with so many people coming from the East and moving to the West, there was a revival of Greek study, a revival of a study of the classics, the Roman philosophers, the Greek philosophers. They brought with them a renewed interest in and commitment to studying the things that had, at least to some degree, been lost in the church in the Middle Ages. So with that revival in classical learning, there was this sense that people had. This is when people began to talk about the Middle Ages as having been the Dark Ages. The classical period was the Enlightened period, was the time when philosophers, the Greek philosophers, were expressing things clearly. And so there was this move for people in the Renaissance to look right past the Middle Ages to antiquity. And the dominant force in the Middle Ages had been the church. So when they overlooked the Middle Ages, when they looked back to antiquity, they began to dismiss the church as part of that whole process. I talked a little bit about the sense in which they were considered humanists. They focused on the fruit of human creativity, philosophy, art, literature, those sorts of things. There's one example of, sort of the motto, if you will, of the Renaissance during this period was a quote from Protagoras back in the 5th century BC, a Greek philosopher. He is famous for the quote that man is the measure of all things. Well, Renaissance thinkers took that quote and made it their own and began to express that in their philosophy, in their literature, in their art, began to express that in so many ways. And probably, I thought this was just fascinating when I first stumbled on this some time ago. One of the best examples of that is Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, which is famous from the Da Vinci Code, if you saw the movie, if you read the book. It's the sketch that he has, the drawing that he has of the man with his arms outstretched and his feet straight down, and then it's the same individual with his arms up and his feet spread. And what he's illustrating by that, if you look at it closely, when he's standing like this, he subscribes a square around his feet and his arms, and basically what he's saying is, if you measured a man, and try this at home, it's really pretty interesting. If you measure someone, they basically are the same length from the top of the head to the bottom of the soles of their feet as they are from fingertip to fingertip. Well, Da Vinci was illustrating that in the drawing, just that idea, and when he has the man with his legs spread and his arms spread, he shows a circle connecting those four points. His point is just simply that man truly is in God's creation, and in the Renaissance, you begin to hear less of man or less of God and more of man. Man really is sort of the focus of all of creation, the base of all of creation. That's expressed more and more in different ways throughout the Renaissance. So you see this going on, but the biggest thing that's important to understand about this period is the church is increasingly falling into disrepute, and the great minds of the Renaissance are more and more ignoring the teachings of the church. Now, you can't ignore the church, because the church still is the most powerful or the wealthiest single entity and the most powerful in terms of temporal power, but in terms of interest in what they were teaching, in terms of belief in what the church was teaching, more and more the humanists of the Renaissance are simply losing interest. Well, let me just mention to you a couple of personalities of the Renaissance, because these are names that you'll hear from time to time. Petrarch, he lived from 1304 to 1374, was known as the first modern man. Interestingly, he was schooled in Avignon during the Babylonian captivity that we talked about last week. And he was the one who first began talking about the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages. But being raised in Avignon, not at the court, but being raised in the same town, he got a firsthand taste of the corruption of the papacy and of what was going on there. He also really began to focus on a study of the Latin authors. The Latin philosophers began to resurrect that study of classical learning. Another personality I just wanted to mention is Lorenzo Valla, who lived from 1407 to 1457. Now here's your pop quiz. Does anybody remember my talking about the donation of Constantine? Well, you do, because I talk about it all the time. Who else said yes? Do you remember what the donation of Constantine was all about?
Was it that where Constantine gave a lot of power to the Pope?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's the document that Constantine, as he was leaving to put his capital at Constantinople, at Byzantium, he gave to the Bishop of Rome both spiritual and temporal authority over the lands of the West. And that was critical in the Middle Ages for establishing the authority of the Pope. That was used as an apology for the authority of the Pope. Well, not at that time, no. Constantinople wasn't Muslim until in the 1400s when the Turks overran it. Prior to that time, it had been Christian, Orthodox, Greek, but it had been Christian. But here's the key thing. I told you to remember the donation of Constantine. Lorenzo Valla, with his study of the classics and with the tools that he was learning to use during the Renaissance, discovered that the donation of Constantine was a forgery. It had been forged somewhere around the 8th or 9th century A.D. And he came to that conclusion from a couple of perspectives. He argued, first of all, from the point of view of probability. He said, how likely is it that Constantine would have given that sort of authority to the Bishop of Rome when everyone in those days, all of the emperors were trying to coalesce their authority, they were trying to gain more power and more authority. How likely is it that he would give it to the Pope? That was one of his arguments. Another argument that he made was that there were no copies of the document available prior to the 9th century. Coincidentally, right at the time that the document became important in building up the authority of the Pope, that was the time that the first documents were available. But most convincingly, and here's where he really used the tools of the Renaissance, which was focusing on language study, focusing on getting back to, if you're going to study the Greek philosophers, you have to study Greek and know Greek in order to study the Greek philosophers. Latin, well, they all knew Latin anyway, but there was a focus on the languages during the Renaissance. And he argued that the language of the donation of Constantine was not the Latin that would have been used in the 4th century. There were words, he was able to show, there were words that were used in the document that weren't even around in the 4th century. Well, I tell you that story just to illustrate two points. Number one, the revival of learning and the kind of learning that they were doing, they were gaining tools in study and in languages that were going to bear fruit in the Reformation in the years to come. But number two, there was the willingness now to challenge one of those things that provided a pillar of support for the church and for the papacy. There was such disillusionment with the church that people were willing to openly begin to challenge the authority of the Pope at this point. So you can see how far things have gone in terms of the disillusionment people had. Lorenzo Valla, he died, I mean, he was young when he died, but, yeah, that's right, he's in the Swiss Alps somewhere. I mean, he, the...
He wasn't persecuted by the Catholic Church?
No, because at this point, the Catholic Church was concerned almost exclusively with temporal power, spiritual issues, and authority in that sense was not a big issue. And so, this knocked down one of the pillars of temporal authority, but they I mean, the popes had, the church had its own armies, they had their own, by this time, knocking at the philosophical underpinnings would bear fruit later in the Reformation, but at this point it wasn't enough of a challenge to the papacy for them to worry that much about it.
So this would have been 1,000 years after...
after Constantine. Well, the, supposedly it had been written around 312 BC by Constantine, or 312 AD, sorry, by Constantine. But in reality, it was written sometime in the 8th or 9th century. So,
is that coincidentally just about when somebody needed it?
Well, I mean, that, yeah, that certainly was coincidentally the time when the papacy was really becoming, if you'll remember, that's right around the time when Charlemagne was becoming the emperor. He was the king of the Franks. When there was the beginning of this struggle between the popes and the temporal rulers as to who had greater authority. So yeah, that coincidentally was right at the time that. Yeah, that's right. You bet. So, okay, now let me talk just a little bit about Christian humanism in the North, and then we're going to move on to the Reformation. In the North, there was, probably the best way to explain this would be, think of Northern Europe like it's Idaho, and think of Southern Europe, particularly Italy, like it's San Francisco. That was the perspective that that the two geographic areas had of each other. In the South, they considered themselves far more sophisticated, far more enlightened. In the North, they were still clinging to some of these religious ideas. They were still much more committed to the actual beliefs of Christianity. So some of the tools of scholarship, some of the methods of study, some of the emphases that they had in the Renaissance in the South found their way to the North. But in the North, there was still much greater personal devotion. So the Christian humanism in the North was really the folks who were the humanists were themselves devout in their beliefs personally. There were some mystical movements toward the end of the Middle Ages that found their way to Northern Europe. Now, when I talk about mystical movements, I don't want to be misunderstood or overstate it. When you talk about mystics in the North, it isn't as though they spent all their time sitting around waiting for visions, waiting for dreams, that sort of thing. There was, in both schools of the Renaissance, there was a tremendous focus on what was called the contemplative life. The contemplative life was basically find yourself a corner to study and just go study, think, process things, write. That was the focus of much of the Renaissance in both the South and the North. So when we talk about mysticism in the North, don't think of it as someone who really is spacey all the time. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, really is completely out of touch with things. Mysticism in the North was a focus on the contemplative life that was in a Christian context. And so, yes, there were some examples of, almost of visions, that sort of thing, but that wasn't the focus. When I talk about mysticism, I think our tendency is to think something different than what was actually their experience in the North. But there was a mystical movement. It was largely a response to the corruption of the church. It was an expression of the desire for the reform of the church. One of the personalities, and let's face it, one of the reasons I like Christian humanism is because it started in the Netherlands. So, one of the great personalities of Christian humanism in the North was a man by the name of Gerhard Groot. He lived from 1340 to 1384. Had a brilliant academic career in Paris and in Cologne at the universities there, but he was converted in 1374, just 10 years before his death. You read about some of these folks, and they had short lives. I mean, this this individual died when he was 44 years old, and these are many of the lives are cut short not by martyrdom or anything like that, but simply by natural causes. Well, he was converted in 1374. He gave himself to a devout and simple life. He became a missionary preacher, traveled around the Low Countries, around Germany, and people began to follow him, and a movement formed around him that came to be known as the Brethren of the Common Life. It was not, strictly speaking, a monastic order. The Brethren of the Common Life heavily influenced some of the monastic orders. Luther was an Augustinian monk, and he was heavily influenced. He was schooled by the Brethren of the Common Life, heavily influenced by that tradition. So it wasn't itself a monastic order, but they were very influential with some of the monastic orders. But most importantly, they founded schools all over Northern Europe at that time, and the Brethren of the Common Life provided much of the education, much of the best education that was going on. They were known for their scholarship, but they were known also for having a critical, that is, in the sense of being willing to consider critically what was going on in the world at that time. They had a critical and a reforming spirit. They were looking at wanting to reform the church because the corruption and the decadence of the church had found its way to the north as well. They focused a lot of their study on the church fathers. They focused on the Old Testament and on the New Testament, beginning to focus now on the study of the Old Testament and the New Testament in the original languages. So one difference between humanism in the South and humanism in the North was in the South, the focus was much more on secular philosophers. In the North, the focus was more on church fathers and New Testament and Old Testament studies. You began to see Hebrew grammars being produced for Christians in order to give them the tools to be able to study the Hebrew Bible. Eventually, we're going to see with Erasmus in a little bit, Erasmus actually pulled together and published a Greek New Testament, which was something that they had not had available to them for study for many, many years. Students of the scriptures in the Middle Ages did not study the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. They studied the Latin Vulgate. That was the version that they used. Well, with Christian humanism, they focus on a study of the languages, New Testament, Old Testament, that really, as we'll see in a little bit in the life of Martin Luther, really began to pave the way for the Reformation by giving more and more people a familiarity with what the scriptures had to say. I've got to mention Erasmus. Desiderius Erasmus lived from 1469 to 1536. He was known as the Prince of the Humanists. And Erasmus, he was Dutch, but I don't like him. I hate to say it. It was very interesting in one of the Gutenberg discussions a couple of years ago. I sat in on one of the discussions, was there to sort of help with the discussion. And we were talking about Luther and Erasmus, and it didn't go very well. But it didn't go, it was very interesting because the students, the Gutenberg students, having read some of Erasmus, absolutely loved him. And they looked at Luther and they thought, what a horrible guy. I mean, what a terrible person he was compared to Erasmus. Well, I'll give you my slant on things because I'm teaching the class here. Erasmus, as the again, he was known as the Prince of the Humanists. He was known throughout Europe as a tremendous scholar. North, South, it didn't matter. He spent a lot of time in England. He was a contemporary of Thomas More. Thomas More of the movie Man for All Seasons, thank you. Thomas More, who wrote Utopia. In fact, the two of them were often together and did a lot of their writing at the same time, dedicated books to each other, so they were both very good friends. Erasmus was known for his scholarship all over Europe, but if you can picture the Christian humanists walking this fine line between the secular humanism of the South and some form of devotion, some sort of commitment to biblical belief in the North, many of the Christian humanists were walking that line. And when the Reformation came along, they had to decide which way they were going to go. If they were going to go with what they in their teaching and in a lot of the things that they had done, they paved the way for the Reformation, and they had to decide if they were going to go that route or if they were going to basically side with the Catholic Church. Well, Erasmus was one of those who for years, when the Reformation got started, tried not to take sides. And everybody wanted him to take sides. He was in communication with some of Luther's followers, and they thought for a while that he would side with the Lutheran Reformation. He had become very famous as a scholar 10, 15 years before the Reformation. So he was being pressured to take sides, refused to for years. But when he finally recognized that he was going to have to take sides one way or the other, he basically said, at the point at which Luther was condemned as a heretic and was supposed to be burned at the stake, what the church wanted to have happen to Luther. At that point, Erasmus said, "You know what? I'm just not cut out for martyrdom," and so he at that point threw in his lot with the Catholic Church. So, I'm showing my bias here, even though he was a tremendous scholar. He was the one, as I said a little bit ago, who put together the Greek New Testament. That was the Greek New Testament that Luther studied as he prepared his lectures on Romans and was the source of so much of his theological insight. Even though Erasmus went a long ways down the path when it got right up to crunch time and he had to decide whether or not he was willing to lay his own life on the line, he declined to do that. So that's all I have to say about Erasmus. Okay, we're going to move into Martin Luther now. Does anybody have any questions about what we've covered so far before we jump into Martin Luther? Yes, Margaret.
Are there any respected Catholic historians? Is there a version of history substantially different from a Protestant?
Oh, no. Well, yeah. I mean, but what's interesting, the question Margaret asked was, would a Catholic's version of history be different from a Protestant's? What's interesting is in the last several decades, the versions of history have come much closer together. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, make a couple of references, and then we'll talk some more about that in the weeks to come. The Reformation, for probably 40, 50 years, absolutely tore Europe apart. And there was just the bitterest of fighting, even wars, between Catholics and Protestants. But the Counter-Reformation, which we'll talk about in a few weeks, we'll talk about fairly briefly, the Counter-Reformation was an acknowledgement that there were, in fact, tremendous abuses in the church of that day. And they set about trying to reform many of those abuses within the church. Well, as the years have gone by, and more recently here in the last century or so, there has been a much greater acknowledgement that things weren't quite as black and white. Historians are seeing that things weren't quite as black and white as they had perhaps thought. And particularly, the Catholic Church really has been willing to acknowledge. They haven't painted a rosy picture of what the church was like in the Middle Ages. They've acknowledged the shortcomings, the problems with the church, and in doing that, have tacitly acknowledged the need for reformation. Not that the form it took, not that the splitting of the church, the splitting of Europe was something that anyone wanted. We'll see this with regard to Luther in a little bit. Luther didn't want that, but there's been the acknowledgement that things were pretty bad with the church in the Middle Ages. Okay. Let's talk about Luther. And I can't remember on your heading. Do I have Luther and the Anabaptists? We're not going to talk about the Anabaptists today. We're just going to talk about Luther. And let me go back and give you again a little bit of a setting for the Reformation, a setting from an economic perspective, social perspective, political perspective, to kind of set the stage for you here. The Reformation began in Northern Europe, began in Germany. Northern Europe had been developing and had become a much more civilized, much more developed part of Europe than it had been just a few hundred years earlier. Trade, you think about the Netherlands during this time frame, during the 15th and 16th centuries, the Netherlands was a huge trade center in all of the world. There were Dutch ships sailing all over the world about this time. So you see that Northern Europe is finally catching up with Southern Europe in terms of its economy, in terms of its culture, those sorts of things. There's a major shift all around Europe that has been going on for a couple of hundred years from a medieval, feudal, and barter economy to a much more modern economy. In the Middle Ages, you basically had landowners and serfs. That was pretty much it. If you were a serf, you were tied to the land. If you were a landowner, you had pretty much complete control over the serfs that were attached to your land. Well, with the end of the Middle Ages, with the Renaissance and on into the Reformation, there's a complete change with a middle class coming into play that now stands between the landowners and the serfs. You have the development of cities. With the development of cities, you have trade, you have a merchant class, you have people traveling. Europe is much safer for being able to travel from place to place than it had been in the Middle Ages. So you have a change in society that allows for people to be freer in where they live, freer in their associations. There's a much more widespread dissemination of ideas. When you have people traveling, whether it's students, merchants, traders, when you have people traveling, they take with them news of the town, news of new ideas. They take with them all sorts of things that spread around Europe in a way that wouldn't have been possible 200-300 years earlier. So you have these changes going on. Socially, there's the rise of the middle class. Feudal knights have really lost their place in society because you have kings now developing standing armies. They're not as dependent upon knights who have their own lands. So more and more you have knights who have no lands, who are roaming around Europe and often is not getting into trouble, quite honestly, because they still have some sort of status as nobility, but they have no lands to show for it, and they don't have the support from any lands. We've talked about the widespread corruption in the church. The church at this time owns somewhere between a fourth and a third of all of the property in Europe. So the wealth of the church is absolutely unbelievable at this time. We talked about the mobility. We talked about a little bit ago about the invention of the printing press. That can't be overemphasized, rather. When the printing press was invented by Gutenberg in 1450, it allowed for ideas, news, to race around Europe much faster than it ever would have before. Whereas before, if somebody wrote a book, if that book was going to be disseminated, it had to be hand-copied. Well, now with the printing press, you can get a lot more copies out a lot faster, and thus ideas are getting out much faster, much further than they were before. Politically, just to give you some ideas, Italy is not united as a country. There are a lot of different city-states in Italy, but the Pope really doesn't have ultimate control, but the Pope is tremendously influential. The Pope has his own army by this time. The Pope has his own lands, as well as the church is owner of the lands of all of the church around Europe, at least in principle anyway. So Italy is not united, but has a number of different states. You see France, England, Scotland are beginning to become unified independently, beginning to develop their own identity. Spain, likewise, is beginning to coalesce with its own identity. Much of the rest of Europe, though, is made up of the Holy Roman Empire. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing, because the Holy Roman Empire was Germany, parts of Austria, parts of Switzerland. Let me see if I can... the Low Countries, the Netherlands and Belgium, Czechoslovakia, some parts of what is now Poland, some parts of what is now France, some parts of what is now Italy. The Holy Roman Empire was a very loose collection of principalities and of minor states that were all collected together under the title of the Holy Roman Empire. So there is one emperor, a Holy Roman Emperor, but his domains, if you will, are made up of people of all sorts of different nationalities, speaking different languages, with different loyalties. The Holy Roman Empire, although it was the biggest and in a sense the most powerful empire in Europe at the time, at the same time was just a little bit of a confused jumble there. The Germans in the north were increasingly disappointed with the Pope, with the Church taking advantage of them. The Holy Roman Empire, just after the Reformation began, the Holy Roman Empire, there was the King of Spain, who was Charles I. There was the King of France, who was Francis I. And the two of them basically got into a bidding war to see which of them would be the Holy Roman Empire. So even with the Empire, there was this jostling for power, this infighting that was going on to see who would be most powerful. It ended up being Charles I, who became, his title as emperor was Charles V, but as King of Spain, he was Charles I. But when he was elected, it's interesting because when he was elected emperor, the Germans put all sorts of restrictions on him because picture it geographically. The emperor was elected by seven electors who were all Germans. The electors, those were seven posts, positions of authority in Germany. There were three archbishops, the Archbishop of Mainz, of Trier, and of Cologne. Of Cologne. There were three archbishops who were electors, and then there were four secular princes, the King of Bohemia, the Count Palatine of the Rhine, the Duke of Saxony, and the Margrave of Brandenburg. Those four rulers, temporal and spiritual, were the ones who elected the Holy Roman Emperor. Well, they were all German, and they had to decide between a French king and a Spanish king. And finally, their decision, rested on the guy that had the most money and the most power, but part of their decision was placing some restrictions on the emperor in terms of the flow of money to the south, to the church in Rome, in terms of restrictions that he could place on the Germans. So right at the time that Luther is about to come on the scene, the Holy Roman Emperor is himself in something of a weakened state at this point. We've talked about the status of the church. It's become very institutionalized. Anti-clericalism is rampant. People are very resentful of the clergy. The authority of the Pope has been weakened. We've talked about all those things. And at that point, then, onto the scene comes Luther, who is really had absolutely no intent of doing what he ended up doing. He had no intention of creating the sort of questions and the sort of issues that ended up truly splitting the church and splitting all of Europe right down the middle. Let's talk about Luther, and I'm actually going to read from time to time, read out of a biography of Luther. If you want some very interesting reading. You can find it at most any used bookstore. Roland Baton was a church history professor, well, just a history professor, not church history. He was at Yale. Roland Baton is was an outstanding scholar of the Reformation. He wrote several Reformation textbooks, the Reformation of the 16th century. He wrote all sorts of different histories of the time, but his biography of Martin Luther, it's called Here I Stand, A Life of Martin Luther, is absolutely outstanding. It is really fun, interesting reading. If you want to get a personal look at what Luther was all about, as well as insight into the movement, insight into his ideas, that's a great book to pick up. When my kids were little, I told each of them that I'd pay them $5 if they read the book, and couldn't get any of them. I don't think any of them ever read it, but I tried for years. But it's just a great story. So, pardon? Okay. All right. Let's talk about Martin Luther. Born in 1483 in Erfurt, Germany. His father was a miner, so his father was of one of the lower classes, not the lowest class, but of the lower classes. Worked his way up to become the owner of several foundries, so his father actually became a man of some wealth. Luther himself was schooled under the Brethren of the Common Life. In 1505, I think he was traveling either to or from the university, I can't remember, but in 1505, so he would have been 22 years old, while he's traveling on the road, he's traveling in the midst of a rainstorm, and tradition has it, and I think Baton says that it's factual. While he was traveling on the road, he was struck by lightning. So, struck by lightning, and he responded the way any good medieval man would have responded. He responded by saying, "Saint Anne, I'll become a monk." St. Anne was the patron saint of the miners, so he called on the patron saint for protection, the patron saint of his father's trade, and his response to being struck by lightning was, "This must be God's way of getting my attention, so I'll do what I need to do, I'll become a monk." So he made that commitment. His father was, this is a recurring theme in church history, his father wasn't real happy with him, because his father wanted him to study law. That's what he had been studying at the University of Erfurt. Wanted him to study law so that he could support his father in his old age. But Luther was determined to become a monk. He joined an Augustinian monastery a couple weeks later. And as an Augustinian, he was a part of, again, the tradition of the Brethren of the Common Life. Erasmus was a part of the Brethren of the Common Life. Thomas a Kempis, I don't know if that name's familiar to you. The Imitation of Christ is a book that Thomas a Kempis wrote, which was something of a devotional work in during the period of the Renaissance here. Thomas a Kempis was part of the Brethren of the Common Life. So Luther, by joining an Augustinian monastery, was part of a strong devotional and academic tradition. Once he joined the monastery, though, he continued to study at Erfurt. He began to study theology. In 1511, he was actually sent to the University of Wittenberg to teach theology. I'm just going to give you some dates here that you can write down, and then we're going to talk more about Luther personally. In 1512, he received his Doctor of the Bible degree. And at that point, he received that having studied the Bible, and now he was in a position that he could teach the Bible. That was 1512. Now, the 95 Theses were pounded on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. We'll talk about this in a few minutes. In 1517, it should be noted that he began to teach the Bible in 1512. From 1512 to 1513, he taught the Psalms. From 1514 to 1516, he taught Romans. And it was, I mentioned this several weeks ago, it was this odd thing about the church in the Middle Ages. it wasn't until it was his responsibility to teach the Bible that he ever read the Bible. He had not done virtually any reading of or study of the Bible itself until that was his charge as a student and as a professor. And we'll go through all that again here in a little bit. The last significant date, he died in 1546, and we're going to fill in a whole bunch of information in between. But went into the monastery when he was 22, went to Wittenberg a few years later, and about 12 years after that was when he really sparked the Reformation with the 95 Theses. Well, Luther was... He was an interesting sort because he truly wanted to figure out what to do to please God. But caught in the medieval tradition, he had no clear idea of what that was. And he sought for answers in the church. He tried to find answers in the church and found himself stymied all the time. He entered the monastery truly out of fear. You see that in his conversion experience. It was a response of fear that caused him to make the commitment to enter a monastery. And that fear you see throughout, even after his evangelical awakening, if you will, you see some of that fear still lingering, not nearly to the degree that it was before this, but he enters the monastery in 1505, and for the next 7 to 10 years, he does everything he can think of to try to please God, to try to get God to look favorably on him, and there is nothing that he can do that he thinks will satisfy God. Truly a man of the Middle Ages in having that fear of a judgmental, of a harsh and judging God. He expected the monastery would be the surest road to heaven. We talked about that several weeks ago when we talked about the establishment of monasteries. There was the mentality that if I make this commitment, if I take this route into the monastery, that somehow or other that's going to be the best way to get to heaven. In the cloister, he refers to himself as a monk's monk. He did everything that was required of him and more. I'm going to read to you a section out of Here I Stand that talks about what Luther's life was like in the monastery. And some of these sections are a little bit longer, but it's good writing. It's interesting stuff, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. Luther in the monastery, it says, he fasted sometimes 3 days on end without a crumb. The seasons of fasting were more consoling to him than those of feasting. Lent was more comforting to him than Easter. He laid upon himself vigils and prayers in excess of those stipulated by the rule. He cast off the blankets permitted him and well nigh froze himself to death. At times he was proud of his sanctity and would say, "I have done nothing wrong today." Then misgivings would arrive. "Have you fasted enough? Are you poor enough?" He would then strip himself of all save that which decency required. He believed in later life that the austerities had done permanent damage to his digestion. And then here's a quote from Luther. He says, "I was a good monk, and I kept the rule of my order so strictly that I may say that if ever a monk got to heaven by his monkery, it was I. All my brothers in the monastery who knew me will bear me out. If I had kept on any longer, I would have killed myself with vigils, prayers, readings, and other work." And then Baton goes on, he says, "All such drastic methods gave no sense of inner tranquility. The purpose of his striving was to compensate for his sins, but he could never feel that the ledger was balanced. Some historians have therefore asserted that he must have been a very great sinner, and that in all likelihood his sins had to do with sex." I guess that's what historians always think. It's always a problem with sex. But where offenses are the least capable of any rectification. But Luther himself declared that this was not a particular problem. He had been chaste while at Erfurt. He had never heard a woman in confession. And later at Wittenberg, he had confessed only 3 women, and these he had not seen. Of course he was no wood carving, but sexual temptations beset him no more than any other problem of the moral life. The trouble was that he could not satisfy God at any point. Commenting in later life on the Sermon on the Mount, Luther gave searching expression to his disillusionment. Referring to the precepts of Jesus, he said, "The word is too high and too hard that anyone should fulfill it. This is proved not merely by our Lord's word, but by our own experience and feeling. Take any upright man or woman. He will get along very nicely with those who do not provoke him. But let someone proffer only the slightest irritation, and he will flare up in anger. If not against friends, then against enemies. Flesh and blood cannot rise above it." Well, that just, and we'll see more, that just expresses some of the personal turmoil that Luther was going through as he was trying to please God and could not find a way to please God. Well, in 1510, while he was still at Erfurt, he was sent to Rome on some business for the monastery. There was a dispute, and they went to Rome to consult with the Pope to try and resolve it. So he went to Rome, and while he was in Rome, he was thinking, okay, this is the place where I'll be able to, we talked last week about the treasury of merits, whereby the merits of the saints were stored up, and if you went to the right places, did the right things, you could basically partake of their merits to deal with some of your own sin. Well, Rome was the place where around every corner there were collections of relics, and there were places where saints had been buried and where there were different things that he could do that he expected, that he thought would allow him to be reconciled to God. So he went to Rome. Instead, he was absolutely horrified by what was going on with the church there. The Pope at the time was Alexander VI, better known in history as Rodrigo Borgia. You've probably heard the name Borgia. The Borgias were, there was an Italian family that absolutely corrupt. Two of Borgia's, I can't remember if they're his children or a niece and nephew, but his children, Cesare and Lucrezia Borgia, they were known for their personal corruption. They were known for the things that they were doing to try and attain power. People were poisoned. In fact, when Alexander VI died, some people say that he died by drinking the wrong cup, that there had been poison prepared by somebody else, and he ended up drinking some of the poison that he was preparing for someone else. But this is what Luther found in Rome, just tremendous corruption and decadence in the church. And there's a description of his time in Rome here, out of Bainton's book. It says, the question, this is talking about being in Rome and the merits that one could find there in Rome. The question was whether they had any superfluous merit which could be conveyed to Luther or to his family, and whether the merit was so attached to sacred places that visits would confer benefit. This was the point at which doubt overtook him. He was climbing Pilate's stairs on hands and knees, repeating a Pater Noster for each and every one, kissing each step for good measure, in the hope from delivering his grandfather's soul from purgatory. Luther regretted that his own father and mother were not yet dead, and in purgatory so that he could confer on them so signal a favor. Failing that, however, he resolved to release his grandfather Heine. The stairs were climbed, the Pater Nosters were repeated, the steps were kissed, and at the top Luther raised himself and exclaimed, not as legend would have it, that the just shall live by faith. He wasn't yet that far advanced. Rather, what he said at the top of the stairs was, who knows whether it is so? He went to Rome to try to engage in all of what Rome had to offer, all of the spiritual blessings, if you will, that Rome had to offer, and instead he found himself disillusioned and frustrated at every turn. Well, back in the monastery, he continues to try to find salvation through penance, through contrition, confession, satisfaction, always wondering, is he sincere enough? Does he remember all his sins? He's always plagued by these things at every turn. He's sent to Wittenberg in 1511. In Wittenberg, he came under the authority. The vicar of the Augustinian order there in Wittenberg was Johann von Staupitz. Von Staupitz was a man who seemed to have been a very gentle, very sincere, very thoughtful individual. And he looked at Luther, and there were times when he just had to laugh because Luther would beat himself up. I mean, literally as well as figuratively, he would do everything that he could to try to make himself righteous. And von Staupitz basically just tried to get him to ease off a little bit. It was under von Staupitz's direction that he began to study the Bible in order to teach the Bible. And von Staupitz throughout his life ended up having a strong influence on him. But no matter what he did during this time, he could never be satisfied. Let me read another section out of the biography here. This is talking about, this is actually a quote from Luther that expresses what he was thinking, how he was feeling at the time. He says, It is not against all natural reason that God, out of his mere whim, deserts men, hardens them, damns them, as if he delighted in sins and in such torments of the wretched for eternity. He who is said to be of such mercy and goodness, this appears iniquitous, cruel, and intolerable in God, by which very many have been offended in all ages. And why? And who would not be? I was myself more than once driven to the very abyss of despair, so that I wished I had never been created. Love God, Luther says, I hated him. That's the point that he got to in trying to do everything that the church allowed for at that time, in that culture, in that setting, trying to do everything that the church made provision for to be righteous, to be sinless, to be able to deal with his sin, and finding himself always frustrated, always wondering if it was enough, always falling short. Well, he's assigned by Staupitz with studying the Bible. He begins to study it, to teach it. There were a couple of points of real enlightenment, if you will, for Luther as he's studying the Bible. One of these was, as he's teaching the Bible, rather, one of these is as he's teaching Psalm 22. Now, I don't know if you remember Psalm 22. It's the psalm that the opening words are the words Jesus spoke on the cross when the psalmist says, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And if you read through that psalm some more, you'll see that when Jesus spoke those words on the cross, he was identifying himself with what the psalmist had gone through. Later on in the psalm, the psalmist says, "Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. O my God, I cry by day, but thou dost not answer, and by night, but I have no rest." And a little bit later in the psalm, he says, "I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people." Well, what Luther found as he studied through the psalm, and this was a turning point for him, was that Jesus was identifying himself as the one who was despised and rejected by God. And in so doing, he began to come to some basic understanding that there was nothing he could do, and this is where you have the beginning of this awakening that he has, there was nothing that he could do to please God. And that in fact, that is what Jesus had come to do, to take his place on the cross, to experience that which Luther himself acknowledged that he deserved. Everything that he did in his own life, he tried to punish himself in ways that would make God pleased with him. And as he's studying through the Psalms, he begins to acknowledge that Jesus himself was the one who had taken his place in being the object of God's wrath there. Well, it's worth noting later on in Psalm 22, he sees Jesus identified when Psalm 22 goes on to say, "They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots." So that was where, and I hope I'm communicating what I'm trying to communicate, and that is it was his studying of the Bible that allowed him to see things that he simply had not been able to see before, that the traditions of the church, the practices of the church, had those things, none of them gave him the understanding, gave him the insight that he had simply from reading and studying the Bible. Well, then, obviously, after Psalm 22 is Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, so on and so forth. Luther begins, in his study of the Bible, he begins to see that it is not up to him to try to please God, that he can't please God. There's nothing he can do that will allow him to please God. And he begins to see his own need for, desperate need for God's grace and for God's mercy. Well, he teaches through the Psalms. Then a couple of years later, he teaches through Romans. This is where Luther sees for the first time early in Romans that the just shall live by faith. And when you stop and think about it, that concept turns upside down what the church had been teaching throughout the Middle Ages. For the church in the Middle Ages, it is not that the just shall live by faith. The just shall live by the practices that the church teaches, shall live by the sacraments, shall live by indulgences. That was the philosophy of the church in the Middle Ages. And so for him to read this and for him to study this turned things upside down. Why don't we open some windows again, if that's okay, because I'm getting really hot. I imagine you guys are getting hot as well. Let me read to you, this is second to last section that I'm going to read out of Here I Stand. But this is, again, in Luther's own words about his study of Romans. He says, I greatly longed to understand Paul's epistle to the Romans, and nothing stood in the way but that one expression, the justice of God, because I took it to mean that justice whereby God is just and deals justly in punishing the unjust. My situation was that although an impeccable monk, I stood before God as a sinner, troubled in conscience, and I had no confidence that my merit would assuage him. Therefore, I did not love a just and angry God, but rather hated and murmured against him. Yet I clung to the dear Paul and had a great yearning to know what he meant. Night and day I pondered until I saw the connection between the justice of God and the statement, the just shall live by his faith. Then I grasped that the justice of God is not that righteousness by which through grace and sheer mercy... No, I'm sorry. Then I grasped that the justice of God is that righteousness by which through grace and sheer mercy God justifies us through faith. Thereupon I felt myself to be reborn and to have gone through open doors into paradise. The whole of the scripture took on a new meaning, and whereas before the justice of God had filled me with hate, now it became to me inexpressibly sweet in greater love. The passage of Paul became to me a gate to heaven. So again, understand that what is going on in the life of Paul, or in the life of Luther, is he is studying the scriptures, seeing things that he never had occasion to see by any other means in the church. He's a monk. He's schooled in church schools. He's trained in the church from a very young age, and yet he doesn't begin to understand the truths of these things until he sits down with the scriptures in his hands and begins to study them. Well, that marks the personal change that goes on in Luther's life, and I'm going to try to just fly through. We don't have too much time, so I'm going to try to fly through what actually happened in the progress of the Lutheran reforms. Well, I'm not sure how to fly through it, but we'll do our best. We talked a little bit about indulgences a couple weeks ago. Well, indulgences, that was a practice that began during the Crusades when a crusader would be given an indulgence by the church. An indulgence was a remission of sins. In some cases, the temporal punishment of sin, which meant you got out of purgatory sooner. In some cases, it was a full remission of sins. But whatever it was, an indulgence was a way to get forgiveness or a remission of your sins by doing something. And what developed over the years then was, first if you went on a crusade, later on it was if you paid for the crusade. And it got to the point here, when Luther is on the scene, it got to the point that there were indulgences offered for a number of different reasons. Well, again, to set the stage, Luther was a professor at the University of Wittenberg. The University of Wittenberg was the pride and joy of Frederick the Wise, who was one of the seven electors of the Holy Roman Emperor. So he was one of the most powerful men in Germany at this time. Frederick the Wise had perhaps one of the best collections of relics in the whole world. The reason that that's important is because indulgences can be given by the church when one views relics on a certain day, usually on All Saints Day, and there would be other times during the year when one would view the relics and would get an indulgence for the remission of their sins simply by contributing to the church and by viewing the relics. Well, I just got to read to you some of this. Frederick the Wise, by 1520, had a collection of relics that amounted to about 20,000 pieces. Now I'm going to tell you what some of those relics are. Included in this collection, he had a genuine thorn from the crown of Christ, certified to have pierced Jesus' brow. He had a tooth of St. Jerome. He had four pieces of St. Chrysostom. That always makes me a little bit nervous when they talk about having four pieces, but whatever. He had four pieces of St. Chrysostom, six pieces of St. Bernard, and four of St. Augustine. He had four hairs from Mary, along with three pieces of her cloak. He had a piece of Jesus' swaddling clothes. He had parts of Jesus' crib. He had a straw from the manger. He had some of the gold and myrrh that the wise men had brought, a hair from Jesus' beard, and one of the nails from the cross to go along with a piece of bread that had been left over from the Last Supper. Well, by 1520, all of the relics that he had, if the relics of his collection were viewed and the appropriate contribution was made to the church, it would allow one to shorten their time in purgatory by 1,902,202 years and 270 days. See, that's the detail that they went to. They factored in the value, if you will, in terms of drawing on this treasury of merits, the value of each relic, such that you could shorten your time in purgatory for the relics that you viewed that were part of the collection. Well, the reason this comes into play was because even as Luther was developing his own teaching there were a couple of times that he sort of gingerly, carefully began to preach against the indulgences and the collection of relics that Frederick the Wise had. Now, that was touchy because Frederick the Wise was the most powerful man in the territory. He was the guy who supported the university where Luther taught. So it was a little bit of a touchy subject. But what was interesting, and I'll just mention it now, what was interesting was Frederick the Wise, although he died a devout Catholic, was the greatest protector of Luther throughout his life. There's no indication that he ever came to believe Luther's teaching. There's no indication that he embraced the reforms, but he protected Luther and Luther's right to speak up throughout his life. If Frederick had not done that, certainly Luther's life would have been snuffed out much earlier. His books would have not have received the widespread attention that they did. But for some reason, Frederick insisted on protecting him all along. Well, the occasion of the posting of the 95 Theses was at about the same time, in 1517, there's another individual, Albert of Hohenzollern, who is going to purchase, and these stories just, they all bring into play all of the things that we've talked about in the church in the Middle Ages, all of the problems with the church. Albert of Hohenzollern wanted to purchase the Archbishopric of Mainz. The Archbishopric of Mainz was another one of the seven electors. So he already had two bishoprics. He already had purchased two other bishoprics, but the Archbishop of Mainz was the most powerful churchman in all of Germany. So he wanted to purchase the archbishopric. The Pope said, okay, you can purchase it for 12,000 ducats to represent the 12 apostles. And Albert says, well, how about 7,000 ducats to represent the seven deadly sins? Well, they compromised at 10,000 ducats. So he purchased the Archbishopric of Mainz for 10,000 ducats. How much is a ducat, you may ask? Well, as far as I could tell, I mean, it's real hard to tell what the value of coinage was in Germany at this time, but as far as I could tell, 10,000 ducats was about $1 million, which makes sense given he was purchasing the most powerful, the wealthiest church seat in all of Germany at the time. Well, he didn't have the money right handy. Somehow, you know, he checked his wallet, checked his checkbook, didn't have the money to pay for everything. So he went and got a loan from the same family. It was a banking family in Augsburg. He went and got a loan from the same family who was later going to loan Charles I enough money to buy the Holy Roman Emperorship. They were in the business of making loans on titles, but he went and borrowed the money from that family, the Fugger family, and in order to pay it back, then he struck a deal with the Pope, and the deal was he could sell indulgences, and this was a plenary indulgence. This was a pay your money and you get out of jail free. You or one of your descendants gets out of purgatory, goes straight to heaven. Basically, if you buy one of these indulgences, it's as if you had never sinned. You're as innocent as a newborn baby, was the was the picture that they suggested there. So he made an arrangement with Pope Leo X to sell indulgences. Half the money from the sale of indulgences would go to repay his loan. Half the money would go to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Well, Frederick the Wise would not let the indulgence sellers into his territories because he had his own collection of relics. He didn't want somebody else selling indulgences because that would infringe on his business. So he didn't want them in Saxony, but there were people going from Wittenberg crossing, they didn't have to go too far, but they'd go to where the indulgence sellers were in order to buy indulgences because, for heaven's sake, you get a chance to buy your way out of hell. Now, there was a different price for everybody. The plenary indulgence amounted to 25 florins, and florins were about the same value as a ducat. A ducat was about $1,000, worth about $100 at that time. A king, queen, or archbishop would have to pay 25 ducats for the indulgence. Abbots would pay 20. Lower nobility paid 6. The middle class paid 3. Peasants only had to pay 1. But you could simply, by paying that fee, buy your way for yourself or for one of your ancestors, buy your way out of purgatory. Well, it was here that Luther... And this was the pastor in Luther that came out at this point. It was here that Luther took exception to that because from his own experience, he could see how hopeless, fruitless, how pointless was this pursuing forgiveness and righteousness through the means that the church had set up. He could see how ultimately pointless that was. And so he didn't want to see his parishioners go through that, and that was the occasion then for his nailing the 95 Theses on the door of the castle church. It was a challenge to a debate, and the challenge was to a debate over whether or not there was anything to this indulgences business, but then he went far beyond that, because in challenging the indulgences, it necessarily led to a challenge to the authority of the church as well. And that's what's going to spread out from there. Well, we're done because no, it wasn't. Nope, that wasn't it.
we're I've got a lot more to talk about with regard to Luther, so we will wrap him up next week. But that just gets you to the point that that the Reformation begins with the posting of the 95 Theses, which are a challenge to debate these issues about what exactly is the role of the church in terms of the authority of the church and the provisions that it makes for the forgiveness of sins, that sort of thing. And those are the issues that start out small but end up exploding all over Europe. And we'll talk about that more next week. That's it. Oh, does anybody have any questions before we knock off and break up? Yes, Logan.
When you said earlier about the northern part of the church was still accepted mysticism, or people were still involved in that mysticism, contemplation, it sounds like they had a tradition of individualism as opposed to groupthink or the one little grass, the hope mentality that you had in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And that tradition of individualism would necessarily give rise to a person like Luther, who would then challenge access to God, the notion of access to God strictly through the church and sacraments versus personal repentance and prayer and okay.
Yeah, I'm going to tweak that just a little bit. I think you're right on that. But individualism was a part of the Renaissance in general. It was that individualism was a response to the group mentality of the Middle Ages, when the identification in the Middle Ages was that all of Europe was the body of Christ, the Corpus Christianum. So here, for the first time, you see people beginning to express that individualism as they move away from the traditions of the Middle Ages. But in the Renaissance in southern Italy, or in southern Europe, that individualism was very strong, paying almost no attention to the church. Galileo was later. He was later in the 16th century. He was later in the 1500s. I don't remember the exact date, but I checked that again just a week or so ago because I was wondering the same kind of thing. So.
Yes, I guess my question is, it seems like sitting here in your class or that believing in indulgences or whatever is sort of a silly kind of thing. So how much silly thinking does the church have today that is still prevalent? I mean, it's sort of like mind-blowing. Sitting here listening to these people that thought indulgence was buying their way out of sin.
Yeah.
Is that still prevalent today?
Are you talking about in the Catholic Church? I'd say in any established religious tradition, there's a fair amount of silly thinking. So, I mean, we'd each have our own stories as to the silly thinking that we've run across, that we've experienced.
And that's because people are blindly following that religion?
Well, yeah, I think it's because when people begin to embrace tradition and embrace the dogma of any religious system, rather than, I mean, I'll talk just about Christianity here, rather than looking at the scriptures themselves, it's just human nature. In the New Testament church, they start off with the scriptures, and it's just human nature to begin to add on to it from there. And things keep getting added on until you have a Reformation, when there's a call to get back to, this is one of the great cries of the Reformation, Scripture alone, when there's a call to get back to the Scriptures for themselves, well, then you begin to strip away a lot of those traditions and a lot of those things that have been added onto it. So in my mind, it is just human nature to begin to add silly things as we get further and further from the basic truths of the Scripture, and keep adding theological systems and practices and things on top of that. But yeah, it's not at all uncommon. Yes?
You said that Erasmus was the prince of...
The humanists,
Could you explain where he got...
Well, that was just sort of the fame, the reputation that he had amongst the humanists. Uh, he, he, all of the other humanists, that is, all of the other intellectuals, that would be, I'd use the two interchangeably, the intellectual community in Europe at the time all recognized that Erasmus at that time was perhaps the most learned, the wisest, the best scholar amongst the intellectual community in Europe. So there was just a, when he's called the Prince of the Humanists, that's his own peers basically honoring him for his own scholarship and for where he stands in amongst his peers.
So,
Well, in this context, in the context of the Reformation, the humanists, it basically refers to the mode of their study, the type of study that they do. It's their study of the classics being the ancient Greek philosophers, the Roman philosophers. It's their going back to antiquity to study the philosophy and the literature of that day. The humanists, that was just the term that was given to those individuals who partook of that study, as opposed to the scholastics of the Middle Ages that really didn't pay as, I mean, they had some philosophers that they paid a lot of attention to, but their focus was much more on the teaching of the church and on doctrinal ideas rather than the study of the classics. So the humanists in the Middle Ages were the ones who studied the classical literature and philosophy of the ancient world. Just very generally.
You did have to study Plato and Aristotle by this philosophy, but what Peter's talking about, when we go back to the ancient world, they're including the Roman philosophers who were more effective, they're including the Stoics and the Epicureans, and all, so they're being exposed to ancient Greek philosophy that hasn't been integrated into Christian theology, and it's just expanding the horizons of the poet and the dramatists and the poets, the Greek dramatists and poets. Mm-hmm. So it's giving them all kinds of different answers and options that they haven't considered. Mm-hmm.
Daniel.
Yeah, when did the start of the worship of Mary begin in the church? And was it more of an Eastern, like the Theotokos, that kind of thing, the Western church?
Don't know.
It becomes a pretty big character.
Yeah, I could not tell you, I don't know. I couldn't tell you when, where, how it got started, where it developed. By this time, it was very much, I mean, they were in Europe at this time. There was some form almost of worship of the saints. When Luther is struck by lightning, he doesn't call out to God. He calls out to St. Anne. So, I mean, it wasn't quite to the degree that it was going on in the church in the East, but there was at least some of the same trends in the West at this point. Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming, and see you next week.